pretend, cause
it has a way of showing
frustrations without end.
Got to keep from exploding. They say be humble, turn the other cheek, and remember the earth is for the meek. But that's again with two set of rules.
One for winners, one for fools. One for winners, one for fools. Oh yes,
trouble, oh, in my way, so I have one world. Trouble, oh, in my way, so I have one world.
Got to walk right around it.
Trouble, oh, in my way, so I have one world.
I see it
in at the dance, cause you know there's a fire in your heart.
That's right.
Call out your friend, then bring out the juice, then the party up you want, yeah. By the time
broadcast. The unpleasant noise you are about to hear coming from your radio is not a mistake.
I'm the CEO.
it was a dance on Thursday. Celebrated with my friends on a birthday. They clashed it sweet. Love how you play the reggae beat. Me mama tell you, say me love how you do it. See, you look like you did a lose one time, two to nothing. But you come back in a fine style. Burn on the place, so why did we treat? This is how the love begun. Make we put it on repeat. It's the last of the week is the last. Gonna come our way. Hey. When he come our way, always moving, always cruising. He's not fooling around. Such a playboy, not a day boy. Look at me up and down. I won't go. I don't care. I will be his beyond compare. I'm not cruel. I'm not shy. I'm falling for a select. Come away, when he come away, he's the last of the week.
Yeah. Come on, call Santa Man, you're at the microphone, so stick around or don't be no clown, the king can't put it down with I'll tell you.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic. Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican. Nor in America. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. As long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're South.
It's Malcolm X, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X and the politics of race. Malcolm X's life represents an extraordinary evolution and transformation from street hustler and ex-con to an intellectual visionary with a race and class analysis. He went from being a narrow nationalist to incorporating a broad global perspective. He articulated a strong challenge to the system of power and privilege. Consequently, the FBI wiretapped Malcolm, read his mail, and kept him under surveillance. A riveting orator, he gave talks throughout the country, including his famous Ballot or the Bullet speech. On February 21, 1965, Malcolm X was gunned down at the Audubon Ballroom in West Harlem. To talk about Malcolm's life and work and his continuing relevance for today is Michael Eric Dyson. Michael Eric Dyson, a globally renowned scholar of race, religion, and contemporary culture, is the Centennial Chair and University Distinguished Professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of many books, including Entertaining Race and Represent, The Unfinished Fight for the Vote. This classic from the AR archives marks Malcolm X's centenary. It was recorded at the University of Colorado as part of Black History Month in 1995. And now, Michael Eric Dyson on Malcolm X.
Malcolm X remains a haunting figure in the collective imagination of many people of color, but he also haunts the American landscape in broad terms. He does so because he is the supreme embodiment of the ostensible politics of black rage. That is, Malcolm X is the point man in the furious onslaught of black rage directed at the premises and practices of white supremacy. A person who garnered such tremendous acclaim because of his rhetorical scorn heaped upon the heads of those he believed were the detrimental embodiment of ideals that harmed African American people and of a vicious history of racism that undermined African American life. But Malcolm X was much more than a point man in this vicious onslaught and this vigorous onslaught of black rage directed at white supremacy. Now, we should admit that he certainly knew how to manipulate the rhetoric of rage, and not simply at white Americans. Malcolm X was known to, as we all know, police the boundaries of black identity by claiming a privileged spot within the framework of both African-American leadership, but more important, within the framework of identification with average, everyday, ordinary black Americans. Malcolm's appeal was not simply that he forced white people to deal with black people on their own terms, that is, on black Americans' own terms, not the kind of kowtowing and yes-siring and yes-ma'aming and manipulation of the rhetoric of Christian love, even though it masked a universe and a cosmos of passion to resist the function of white racism, that is, to slip through the premises of white superiority, the ingenious manner in which Martin Luther King Jr. and others in the civil rights movement appealed to the conscience of white Americans, and by appealing to the conscience of white Americans to enact a drama of resistance to racial domination. Malcolm X wanted to do it on the terms that were indigenous to the mindset of everyday people. And that is that he spoke in such powerful and lucid ways, with such eloquent oration and declamation, the deepest held, most cherished principles of fierce pride that could scarcely be granted public perception or at least public airing. And yet Malcolm did that. He spoke truth to power in ways that made people uncomfortable, white and black. He was about not only calling a spade, but he was also about going further than merely calling a spade, but to describe the spadeness of the spade. And Malcolm was good for that. In very narrow and bigoted ways sometimes, he appealed to this rhetoric of rage to police these borders of authentic black identity by calling people like King Reverend Dr. Chicken Wing, Uncle Tom, and referring to other black leaders as people who were selling out the interests of the African-American community. And so, contrary to the civil rights movement and the appeal to white conscience and the beneficence of white Americans to somehow find within their collective resources the ethical energy to remove themselves from the most heinous manifestations of racial domination, Malcolm X was of I don't give a damn school. And part of his continuing appeal to so many is the way in which he continues to be frozen in his own rhetorical rage. In Malcolm's own word, they won't let me turn the corner. And the corner he wanted to turn was toward a much broader appreciation of the factors and forces that made African Americans who and what they are, and that would enable them to move beyond narrow, insular, parochial, bigoted preoccupations to a more Catholic understanding of American society. The irony, of course, is that Malcolm was much more American than he was willing to give on to. A person who was obsessed with purity at a certain level can't help but be a certain kind of American. An American, of course, influenced by certain European discourses about purity. The irony, of course, as many intellectual historians tell us, is that even as black Americans look back to America in some kind of inferiority, America looks back to Europe in a similar sense of inferiority. And so the back-looking lends us a kind of genealogy where we understand the quest for purity is a particularly American-European construction that we somehow see manifested in Malcolm's own rhetoric. And so his policing of these boundaries and borders of African-American identity gave way near the end of his life to a much broader embrace of people across the chasm of race. And had we lived, we can only hope of class and sexual preference and gender. But the Malcolm that was more about the broad humanity was the Malcolm who was obscured, marginalized within the history of black American politics because his use within popular culture
is of a figure who gives authority to young, especially African-American men and women, caught in niches of political powerlessness within the urban post-industrial city. Post-industrial cities which capture the lives of so many young people of color. Malcolm's lifestyle resonates with the choices and chances that young people of color have in many of these post-industrial urban slots. The decreased ability to get a, shall we say, high-waged, low-skilled job. The decreased ability to operate within an American economy that is increasingly captive to technological forces and the so-called super information highway that has few exits in the black community. The so-called ability to participate in American democracy that is decreasingly available to average ordinary Americans and especially people of color. And so Malcolm's rhetoric appeals, understandably, to young people looking for bold, defiant gestures, rhetoric that will speak the kind of hidden, masked rage at some points and the quite explicit rage that they feel toward a system that fundamentally refuses to accept, understand, or concede their humanity. And the debate about humanity connected to people of color, African peoples in America, is, as many intellectual historians have reminded us, a relatively new invention in modern Western society. The notion that people of color could engage in abstract rationality, could somehow make connections between concepts that were not immediately or available or concrete, is a relatively new development in the evolution of thinking about people of color. And Malcolm connected viscerally to that realization. In other words, he understood quite clearly that what was at stake was not rhetoric, but reality. What was at stake was the very conception of people and human beings. And so what he did was make it so clear that it was virtually unbearable, not simply by white Americans who were taken aback. This was not "We Shall Overcome." This was not "Sing Along with the Bouncing Beat of Harmony and Brotherhood." This was rather in-your-face refusal to concede any ground to the morality of American public discourse about race. It was an unwillingness to even acknowledge that there was a fundamental logic that undergird American public discourse about race, and if it was a logic, it was a viciously circular one. And Malcolm pressed that claim in public in ways now that young black people looking for very explicit articulations of rage and anger and also very particular defiances expressed toward the dominant powers that be. The problem, of course, is the changed racial landscape we have inherited as Americans. As the increase of black middle class, as the upward social mobility has differentiated the classes in African-American society so that under segregation, when school teachers in the middle class were forced to live with people who were so-called working class and even the permanently poor, the so-called ghetto poor, there was a kind of common experience forged as a result of the rigid rule of segregation in northern industrial cities as well as the rural South. So that you could be in Harlem and, you know, you could be a poor boy, but at least you could see Paul Robeson coming down the street.
"No more auction block for me."
"How you doing, Mr. Robeson?" "Go up the street and Langston Hughes might be writing, 'I've known rivers, deep, deep rivers,' right? You go up the street and so on, this mythical, you know, it is romantic and utopic at a certain level. Not to suggest that class divisions weren't riven throughout those African-American communities tightly contained, rigidly turfed by segregation and the forces of an American culture that refused to allow the expansion of black life beyond certain geographical limitations. But the geography of imagination expanded, as well as the opportunities of people of color to move beyond these rigidly segregated enclaves. And so what happens with this upward social mobility is the class differentiation within African-American culture. And so the difficulty of merely appealing to rage that is more than radical chic, rage that refuses to address its own class contradictions, race language that refuses to acknowledge that all black folk are not the same, so that the disproportionate influence of certain segments of African-American middle class within the context of black politics and the larger context of African-American society means that we've got to back up and then use Malcolm's most broadly humanitarian legacy to try to force a rethinking of the politics of race in American society. And I want to suggest a few ways in which that can occur. First of all, the rethinking of class differentiation within African-American culture was a force that Malcolm intuited in his latter day career and grabbed onto in a vigorous way as he improvised in the last 50 weeks of his life. Here was a person then who understood that the battle was much more international than we had been led to believe. That as he visits the Congo, as he goes through the Gold Coast, as he goes throughout Africa and Mecca, as he goes throughout the world, he begins to understand that socialist politics may be a way of gaining more participation of people over in the governments that regulate their lives and more control over the institutions which govern their lives, which meant that Malcolm began to understand the necessity for a fierce engagement with class politics and to address the enormous class inequalities and inequities that were rife in American culture and that increasingly were characterized in African-American life. This, by the way, is the same insight to which King was granted access in the latter part of his career. We remember King now for I Have a Dream, Pepsi-Cola commercials, McDonald's, talk about him, that great dreamer, that wonderful man, pictures, the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, Let Freedom Ring from Lookout Mountain in Tennessee. And that's all good, but the reality is that the echo that came back to King from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado was the reality of Watts fires on the ground. And so this forced him, this coerced him into a much more radical disposition in vis-a-vis American politics. It forced King to see the necessity for a revolution of values. Similarly then, with Malcolm X, he began to perceive the necessity for engaging in class warfare. And that class warfare had already been anticipated to certain degrees in his own Nation of Islam experiences, where he harped upon the narrownesses and bigotries and blindnesses of the petty bourgeois Negro leaders who were pimping, in his own words, and prostituting, in his own words, the average everyday African American. And so Malcolm began to see the necessity for what I will term, in a kind of, you know, backshadowing, as Gary Morrison calls it, radical democracy. That is the need for people to have some say over the institutions which run their lives. And this Malcolm, then, is not the one who is easily appropriated by popular culture, even though I think the ingenuity of Spike Lee's presentation of Malcolm X is that it at least showed us an intellectual Malcolm X, a black man manipulating rhetoric in American culture in the cinematic expression for 4 and 5 minutes at a time. The focus was on his verbal rhetorical skills, his oratorical declamation, his ability to engage in forensic debate with the most fierce of enemies and yet to come out on top. This was an enormous achievement in an anti-intellectual environment, but also it implicitly put forth the proposition that people of color had ideas, even those who were on the so-called fanatic fringe. But even that film failed to grasp the profound complexities of Malcolm's latter-day international vision. Even that film failed to address the enormous transformations being wrought in Malcolm X near the end of his life, when he began to look beyond the pale of race and beyond the mere confinements of ethnic specificity, to look to see that class was a powerful force and that economic misery was spread throughout African American communities. If racism is destroyed, African American people are still poor. Now, Malcolm was not willing to give up on the particular formation of race in terms of personal identity or in terms of its impact upon most people who were poor. In other words, even when he came back from Mecca, he said, hold up, that was in Mecca. That was in Arabia. You know, that was my Arab brothers and sisters who could be white and light and steal my brothers and sisters. But up here in America, closer to home, he understood that the particularity of race, that he refused to dehistoricize race. He refused to be apolitical about the social meanings of race. He refused to give in to the belief that you could somehow subsume race under this larger category of class. So he had his kind of burgeoning socialist politics in place, but he refused to do what certain vulgar or orthodox Marxist appropriations of race have done, is to re-describe racial misery in terms of larger economic forces. Malcolm wanted to see both of them being given attention to and paid serious intellectual attention to. So on the one hand, he understood that race was still ruling in American society and that class inequalities were somehow linked to racial desperation. But economic misery for Malcolm X was somehow such an important quality of determining the legitimacy of social theory that he wanted to move beyond mere race. This Malcolm we know nothing about. This Malcolm we hear nothing about. This is not the Malcolm, of course, appropriated by hip-hop culture. And the contradictions, as we know, in hip-hop culture between appropriating Malcolm X and his politics of rage and a person like Minister Louis Farrakhan. Now, of course, the contradictions between Minister Farrakhan and Minister Malcolm X are now writ large upon the canvas of American recent American history. We see this expressed, of course, in the Kabila Shabazz debacle that has come tumbling forward from the lunatic mind of both the FBI and the conspiracy predilections, or at least the kind of conspiracy theory that is being propagated within the Nation of Islam. And the interesting thing is, of course, as I've tried to argue before, is that black folk are caught in the middle. People say on the one hand, you know, of course the government can do stuff like this. People say, isn't it rather odd that the government would cook up these plans to try to get at Minister Louis Farrakhan by hatching up a scheme to say he was being hunted by Kabila Shabazz? Well, no, not really, given the history of the FBI, which often meant for brothers' imprisonment. For us, I could see the FBI stood for brothers to be in prison, right? And to infiltrate the movement of African-American men and women to undermine that African-American leadership. Why should we be so amazed that the FBI could do this? On the other hand, pimping the language of conspiracy covered the contradictions of many African-American groups that refused to concede that black folk could disagree and still live together. And this is the problem, of course, by the appropriations in popular culture of the politics of Malcolm's rage and his rhetoric without digging deeper, without excavating, without going beneath the rhetoric, without getting a kind of subcutaneous, beneath the skin of the rhetoric. Excuse those nasty kind of metaphors. But to dig deeper and to get deeper into the ground of Malcolm's own profound reflections upon the necessity for solidarity beyond disagreement. And so the problem in this so-called age of appropriation of race in popular culture is that it doesn't address the class contradictions or the kind of internal group infighting that disallows disagreement. I cannot tell you how many times I've received letters from people. I've written about Leonard Jeffries and other so-called controversial figures and ideas, and they write me letters, call me out my name. Don't call me the name my mama gave me. And then, you know, I get on radio program, they be said, this is the handkerchief head Negro. Uncle Tom, this is the kind of Negro white folk love to invite to their universities. Well, I guess that is true. But the point is, said he's just the kind of guy can be manipulated by them. And then, you know, of course, I get on the radio, and if I'm in a good mood, I try to, you know, be in my Christian self, and I look above it. If I'm in my Detroit Negro style, I'm throwing the dozens right with them. I'll be talking about their mamas and daddies, and, you know, and of course, in style, I don't do it explicitly. I try to mask it, but I try to signify on them, you know? But the tragedy is, and of course, and then I'm caught, because then I get calls from hate monitors, and they call me up, Professor Dyson. we heard the way you were mistreated last night on such and such a radio program. Do you want to file a complaint? Well, I said, I don't want folk talking about me like that. But at the same time, I can't lose sight of the fact that the forces of anti-democratic thinking in American culture are much more profound than these small groups that are going to call me out of my name. I think it's wrong for them to call me out of my name. But I can't allow that to obscure the larger forces at work. The problem, of course, becomes the way in which this intolerance is rearticulated, is reassigned virtue within black groups that want to, in one sense, police the ability of its members to think. This is not simple so-called mere political correctness. I'm talking about something much more profound than that. I'm talking about the way in which people of color, as well as other Americans, but if we're talking about people of color, have to come to a point where we're able to see and say that we have interests beyond the mere reach of race. That we may have more in common as people of color with people like, say, for instance, Barbara Ehrenreich or Stanley Aronowitz or Henry Giroux or Brett Gary than we have in common with Clarence Thomas. That's my vote. That's a personal autobiographical statement. That the mere rubric of race does not capture the complexity of our own conditions as people of color in this post-industrial later part of the 20th century American capital reality. And that means then that we've got to then look beyond the kind of narrow intolerances that rule and regulate the discourse of black organizations. And that means also we've got to deal with the dilemma of class realities on the one hand and inequalities, as well as the persistence of race and its meanings on the other hand. Malcolm saw this necessity near the end of his life. And to move to that ground is to move to a space where we're able to imagine a radically different future, where not only the appropriation by Malcolm's rhetoric in popular culture is recycled in pop culture forms like hip-hop culture or in black cinematic quest for authentic African-American identity, whether Spike Lee or John Singleton, that the agenda will be broadened, that we will begin to come to grips with these powerful internal contradictory forces that refuse to recede when race rhetoric is applied.